So, well, we're still collecting questions. I'll just start with one for you, Susie, that I was thinking about when you were talking about the Cluster Munitions Convention and how they've had success with divestment there. I remember when we first started divestment work, one of the responses that we'd sometimes get from financial institutions was, well, yes, we've divested from cluster munitions producing companies because cluster munitions are illegal. Nuclear weapons are not illegal. So I'm wondering if this is still an argument that you're hearing these days.
Well, actually, yeah, we hear it sometimes, but only primarily from BNP Paribas in France. They come back with this a lot, and they're quite a big, big financial institution. From smaller banks, and pension funds primarily. Pension funds get it. Pension funds are kind of cool, and pension funds are easy targets for us as campaigners because they want to make their clients happy. I don't know why. It's kind of cool. But we don't get they're not illegal as much. And when we do, we come back and say it doesn't matter. It's not a question of legality. It's a question of acceptability. And as I said before, you know, pornography is not illegal, but I don't want my pension invested in it. You know, tobacco is not illegal, but my pension has divested from tobacco producers. You know, there are things that are, you know, ethical standards. And in this, currently we have a great, great global effort on corporate social responsibility. And this fits very well in with those principles of responsible investment and in that CSR movement. And I have to say, I'm really proud to be associated with people working on divestment from fossil fuels. That's showing that it works, and it does. So it's a, like I said, it's a tool we have.
So for Jan, the first question is, have the so-called Four Horsemen made any more recent comments or actions regarding, say, nuclear weapon modernization or the humanitarian impact process that's been going on or the Marshall Islands lawsuit or anything like that, any sort of newer developments in recent years?
Actually, on the contrary, they have toned down considerably in the last few years their call to action. It's so the rhetorical embrace of the elimination of nuclear weapons in 2007 has progressively over time become more modest, and some of the key components of an overall strategy of denuclearization or de-emphasis of nuclear weapons, including the comprehensive test ban. And the comprehensive test ban, which is very crucial to a de-emphasis on modernization of the ability to develop and modernize nuclear weapons around the world, and the fissile material cutoff ban, things like that. If anything, they, and a couple of members in particular, have become less willing to talk to push for change. It's the zeitgeist, right? So they were, in the beginning, in 2007, the ability of those four people to speak out and embrace the vision represented the correlation of forces at the time. That said, and to our second speaker, who is not here, it's very interesting that if you can imagine that if even former secretaries of state and very senior senators feel social pressure to de-emphasize opinions that are seen to be too extreme or out of the mainstream, that it just is a tiny glimpse into the kind of pressure that does come to stay within the boundaries of discourse, even for extremely senior and retired former Secretary of Defense, former Secretary of State. So those are the kinds of things that I think that our second speaker partly was alluding to. I just wrote a book called The Tyranny of Consensus, which is about the pressures on people trying to, quote, stay credible in debates like this one.
Thank you. Back to Susie. We have a question asking if you've targeted very large state and city pension funds from, say, New York State or New York City or California, and if you've had any success with those types of pension funds.
It's a great question. I don't live in this country, so I don't tend to focus on the financial institutions here. I'm not going to lie to you. I focus where I live. I encourage people to do that. We've done quite a lot with the Norwegian Government Pension Fund Global, which is the biggest pension fund in the world in terms of net assets. They're really rich on that Norwegian oil money, and it's quite wealthy. And we've gotten some progress over there. They set a standard for a lot of other financial institutions. I would very much like to speak to people here about targeting the New Jersey Fund in particular. Because the New Jersey Fund is something, it doesn't have a big investment. It's something that no first responder, I could imagine, would want to deal with the consequences of any use of nuclear weapons. What first responder? No. Nobody wants to do that. And why invest in the companies that make that use possible? And I think that, you know, I think it's really worthwhile. I'd be really happy to talk to folks in the area here about how we can get, I think, a couple of cops and firefighters together to say a few things might be really effective. I'm here all day, folks, so let's make that happen. I think it's completely doable, and it's a great win. And it's a great win for the tri-state area.
Okay, so Jan, there's a couple questions here that are in the same stream, thinking about nuclear deterrence, that, as you said, it's indisputable to so many people, and it seems like an insurmountable barrier sometimes when trying to talk about abolition or disarmament. So people are looking for suggestions on how to deflate deterrence's so-called apparent logic, and wondering how did the narrative become so popular in the first place as well.
I think the quest, the post-Cold War quest for some kind of umbrella doctrine that even begins to appeal the way that deterrence or containment managed to do, which could cover a multitude of sins as well as virtues, there's been no successful crafting of the narrative or the bumper sticker for what United States engaged globally in a responsible way. There are too many words. It doesn't work. Containment was great because it sounds, you could do a lot of things under containment. It was everything from diplomacy to the extreme use of force and covert operations, etc. It all fit under that rubric. So it is true, and I listened to Susie, I realized I work with people who believe that nuclear weapons prevent war, who believe that nuclear weapons are highly stabilizing, and who believe that it is absolutely essential for the United States to always have a larger number of nuclear weapons relative to all other countries, because anything less than that is going to be hazardous to security. So there is a big conceptual architecture and political reality there that needs to be dealt with. So your question was, what do you do about it? One of the things I find really intriguing is how the United States has responded to the development of nuclear weapons in smaller states, including North Korea, including the prospective development of nuclear infrastructure in Iran. Even though we argued throughout the Cold War about tens of thousands of weapons and having to be essential in order to maintain parity or superiority with the Soviet Union, the minute that there was reports that there might be one or two crude devices in Iraq, I'm going to get to the point, I swear, prior to Desert Storm, the argumentation was that had we known that there actually were nuclear weapons in Iraq, that could have prevented the assembly of a coalition to go into to punish Iraq for invading Kuwait. So if that's true, then the one or two weapons, suddenly the whole logic of deterrence sort of falls apart, because we used to worry about whether we had 11,000 or 1050 or, you know, even at the lower numbers, we were talking about 4,500, which is really much larger because there were reserve forces. So in talking about, we really do worry about the single or couple of nuclear weapons because we worry about use. And it's part of the conceit of the superpower that our weapons are not for use because we are very responsible, and the more weapons we have, the less likelihood, etc. When you actually look at the legacy of deterrence, it is rife with all kinds of near misses, all kinds of potential accidents, all kinds of averted catastrophes about which Eric Schlosser has written a very accessible book, Command and Control, based on years and years of research that was done, including at the Brookings Institution when I was there, about how close we came, not just in the Cuban Missile Crisis, but many other times, to major nuclear catastrophe. That's the lesson that we should be imparting from the nuclear legacy of the Cold War. And we are really bad at that. We tend to instead impute huge status and power to countries that are developing nuclear weapons instead of trying to educate them about the problems that we ourselves face. Sorry, that was a very long answer to a short question.
No, that's fine. I'm sure it's useful. There was a question that was for me about the comment I made after your presentation about there being support for nuclear disarmament more than deterrence in terms of public opinion. So what I meant there was sort of consistently across global public opinion polls that we've done, there's been a consistent support for nuclear disarmament across a range of countries. So that was just to clarify what I meant by that. Next one for Susie is, I'm so encouraged to see so many colleges and universities involved with fossil fuel divestment. Can you speak on getting educational institutions on board with your Don't Bank on the Bomb campaign?
Yes. A little bit. Right now, our biggest target for Don't Bang on the Bomb this year is in the UK. And I'll tell you why, because UK is making a decision about Trident renewal. And they're slated to make that decision early next year. So we're talking to those who are campaigning so successfully around fossil fuel divestment, who have now really built the skills and energy and enthusiasm to take this, to take issues of social responsibility as far as they can, to use Don't Bank on the Bomb as the next big thing. And we've gotten such great responses and really appreciate the energy that's coming out of that because, you know, once you get your institution to divest from fossil fuels, well, you want to ride the wave of winning, right? It feels good. And so we're trying to build that spirit up. And so now we're talking to 16 groups across the UK to pick this up further. Here in the US, we know that it's picking up as well. And 350.org has done amazing work in the climate on the climate action and on this these global efforts. So we've talked to them a bit about picking things up here in the US, but not as extensively. And that's because for us, it's a strategic decision. We don't want a new Trident system to be bought by the UK, and we think we can make an impact there. So we're not a lot of people. It's me and another guy who work on this, pretty much along with a lot of other responsibilities. So we're trying to maximize our impact, and we're really grateful to the folks in the UK who have taken up this issue. And I know some of them are watching. Hey guys, and we're really enthused by looking at future opportunities. Hopefully here in the US, we can pick that up further. And it's, again, building on success. People want to win. People want to do things that make them feel good. You know, and that's just human nature. And nobody wants to be a bad guy. I think that's pretty much shared wherever we are.
I would agree with that. Okay, Jen, this one's from Helen. What changed the zeitgeist, she asks.
What changed the zeitgeist? The deep state. I mean, I don't put it things that way, but the fact is a lot of things changed the zeitgeist. They were external and internal. I tend to pay attention to the internal and domestic politics of the management of these issues. I don't think there was very much effort put into how you would actually operationalize a strategy that gets you to zero. There was almost no debate at all about the actual practical steps and why, most importantly, perhaps in seizing the high ground, why it was an investment in national security to do so. So it was very quick and easy for critics to seize the notion of zero or elimination and make fun of it, which I have watched now three times in my lifetime happen. So there is a problem with the narrative. It's, you know, the elimination of nuclear weapons sounds to many as an extremely naive, impossible feat. But instead of talking about how there are many states of zero, you could maintain, there are all kinds of ways to do this, were conversations that were going on in Cambridge, Palo Alto, and maybe Melbourne. They weren't happening and didn't happen in Washington, where the extreme partisanship of the nuclear debate seized immediately on something as modest as the START Treaty, and it took everything that everybody had to actually get the START Treaty ratified, which included a bipartisan set of votes in the Senate, and it really eclipsed the whole debate. And, but you know, by the way, Russia has not helped at all in terms of zeitgeist issues. Does that answer your question, Helen?
The question was, how do they make fun of it?
And Helen, you're not supposed to shout questions from
the
audience.
Yeah, that's why I just repeated. I can't stop her, though. It's her symposium. No, I don't know what to do.
It's her party. I think she's allowed to do whatever she wants. It's up to the moderator.
Yeah.
The notion is that, I mean, you've heard all the arguments. That how could you possibly ever get to zero? Any country that cheated, anyone could cheat. You could disguise. All those arguments, which have to do with procedure, they have to do with process, basically, though, still come down to the logic that nuclear weapons empower you, and therefore the possession of even a handful gives you an advantage over others that could not possibly be countered or replicated. And that can be really flawed logic. It's not actually accurate. But it's too, because there wasn't an effort to make this a practical strategy and to work, and I would include, I mean, I think any president who's going to actually embrace this as an operational strategy needs to precede formal public announcements with major coalition building on the inside where you basically separate, even if you continue a policy of deterrence, you separate deterrence from war fighting. If you separate the deterrence function from prompt counterforce, the numbers fall rapidly, and there is a way to do this. But there's going to be a lot of eggs broken, and it requires a lot of skill. And it's something that I actually would imagine the first George Bush being rather capable of having done, given the style of leadership that he exerted, plus his subordinates, who were extremely powerful.
Okay, thank you.
Very powerful.
Yep.
Skilled.
Okay. So my next question for Susie is slightly off topic from your presentation, but I'm going to allow it because I know it's another subject that's very close to your heart and work these days. So wondering if you could comment further on U.S. nuclear weapons in the Netherlands.
Ooh, yeah. Okay, so there's 20 of them, but it's a public secret. So, you know, technically we cannot confirm or deny whether they're there. That's the Dutch government line. And so I can't confirm or deny that they're at a base called Volkel. I can't confirm or deny that Volkel is right next to the town of Uden, which has a very lovely mayor who drinks milk with his lunch. But I can't confirm or deny these things. They continue to be there. The Dutch parliament has issued a number of consensus resolutions saying things like the new joint strike fighters, the F-35s that we're buying, and they're so expensive. Oh. So these new planes, these awesome, you know, do everything planes. The Dutch parliament said we should not pay for them to be capable of dropping nuclear weapons, which I think is pretty reasonable. Dutch Parliament is pretty strong on this. But Dutch Parliament has also instructed the Dutch government to tell the United States that we no longer require their nuclear weapons for our security. Thank you very much. That was, again, another consensus motion. And the government came back and said, yes, we told them. They said they told them, you know. We checked with the ambassador in Washington, it was said. But in terms of policy application, it doesn't get followed up on. And what's really unfortunate is because it was mentioned earlier, these are B-61 bombs. They're being modernized with new capabilities. And this is extremely problematic because a new capability is a new weapon. And our parliament, again, said no new nuclear weapons in the Netherlands. What's great is that they have to leave to be modernized. And so we're hoping that they never come back. The thing is, though, there are weapons and there's capability to store weapons at bunkers around quite a few NATO countries. So it's not just in the Netherlands. They're also in Germany, and the Germans do not like them. But the last German government was a lot stronger than this German government on that issue. They're in Belgium. The Belgian government is unfortunately not very strong on this issue at the moment. And they're in Italy. And the Italian foreign minister, who was amazing on this issue, got promoted out of power into the EU, which is a little bit sad for us. So it's an issue. That is being talked about a bit inside NATO. It's talked about a bit here in terms of the modernization. And for us, you know, even though it's a public secret, we're publicly saying we don't want them and secretly planning on never letting them back in once they leave.
All right, that sounds like a plan. Okay, so Dan, some people were intrigued by the title of your talk and are wondering if you could explain a little bit about the hooligans at the gate.
Well, to be honest, I didn't give my talk, so because I thought you had heard some of it. I was going to contrast the difference between arms control and disarmament. And the important thing about the hooligans part is that it doesn't seem to matter which side of that the discussion one falls on, and often in talking about nuclear weapons, that they capture somehow the core values of individuals. Nuclear weapons is an amazing, the whole issue of nuclear weapons and also strategic defense tend to be reflective of the core values of people in a, maybe not unique, but in a way that I've studied very carefully. So, honestly, I gave that title because Helen was demanding something really colorful, and I'm not very colorful normally, and she had given me a title. It was like the sociopathology of the brutality of the blood-sucking whatever. So I just changed it slightly. But just on the point of, there's a lot of, even in very antiseptic discussions of nuclear weapons, like, people, for example, say, well, I wouldn't feel comfortable if the United States had fewer than 2,500 strategic weapons. If you tell me what your number is, I can probably tell you what your social values are. You tell me zero and so forth. And it's the same with strategic defense. So there is an emotionalism to this discussion and a lot of ideology that reflects interesting core values that have really nothing to do with the pragmatic politics or definitely the operational military and security questions associated with them. But in the end, it really was just to please Helen that I called it hooligans at the gate.
It's a good enough answer. I let her talk from the floor, so she does get away with
a lot.
She's out of control. Okay, Susie, back on the banks. What degree of bank investment goes across international borders to invest in the nuclear industry? So there's an example here that the Royal Bank of Canada invests in uranium mining in Wyoming, and wondering if sort of this cross-border investment is done for the benefit of the investor or if it's to cushion the industry from lawsuits and things like that.
Generally, investments are done to make money. Right? That's why people invest in stuff. And Royal Bank of Canada also invests in a number of nuclear weapon producers, Canadians. And they invest outside of their national borders all the time. We have financial institutions from 31 countries investing in producers from 7. So it's part of the transnational trade. And they do it, I'd say, not so much to avoid, like, what was it, avoid, what did you say?
Lawsuits.
Yeah, it's not so much to avoid lawsuits, it's to make money. You know, that's why you invest in stuff, right? There are alternative investments, and I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. Like, it's not just don't do something, it's do something else. And one of my favorites is you get a 3 times better return investing in Anheuser-Busch, which we all know makes not the best beer. But you get 3 times better return investing in Anheuser-Busch than you do investing in Lockheed Martin. So do you want a 1.7% return or do you want a 4.9% return? I'll go for beer.
Okay, no comment on that.
Nothing to do with karaoke, right?
We have someone wondering, Jan, what happened to General Lee Butler, who was a straight talker about the insanity of nuclear weapons?
That's a great question. Those of you who may not know, he was the commander-in-chief of the Strategic Air Command that, as it shifted over to now what's known as Strategic Command, STRATCOM. And in the course, and as such, was deeply involved in the complete retooling of the nuclear targeting plans on which deterrence rests. And that experience, he retired from the Air Force after that experience, and then he served on a couple of commissions, including the Canberra Commission, which met for 2 years and urged the elimination of nuclear weapons. And from that, he came back to Washington, and he gave speeches about how he had come to the conclusion, as a nuclear warrior and someone who was deeply steeped in every detail of nuclear operations, had come to the conclusion that the greatest investment we could make for security was to eliminate nuclear weapons globally. And what happened to him is that he was ostracized. He was, as many people who dissent in that way, was completely cut off from his lifelong colleagues in the Air Force. He was treated as a, and he himself anticipated this, actually, like, was there when he gave his first speech to the Council on Foreign Relations, and he paraphrased Flannery O'Connor, who said, "Speak the truth, and the truth shall make you weird." And I think he is living in Omaha. I think he has done productive things, but he's not been back in the policy debate for quite some years.
Okay. I think a lot of us can identify with that and being weird. Susie, you wanted to add something?
A quick thing. He actually sent a video message to the Vienna conference, to the civil society forum that was organized by ICANN in advance. But it was talking about the morality and that angle more than the associated security question. So my sense was that from this message he recognized this. He felt weird talking about the security thing, but he talked about the morality of weapons, the unacceptability of weapons, and this humanitarian initiative to focus on that angle. So he may not be active. He's also got a bit old, you know, as people do. But he's definitely connected again, at least a little bit, which is great.
Finish that out. Again, it's part of the sobering nature of this discussion that the fallout, if you will, from his embracing of the vision of the elimination of nuclear weapons, which, by the way, is already American policy and all policy under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. But anyway, it is very outré for a senior Air Force officer who has been head of STRATCOM to say such a thing. But it is very sobering that in part of the effect of his articulation of this view, people said he doesn't know what he's talking about. I mean, it really is very, I study dissent and acts of dissent and what works and what doesn't and what happens, and it really was an extraordinary story.
Okay, it's almost time to break for lunch, but I'm just gonna let one more question in because I think it's a really important one and one that hasn't really come up at all at this conference yet. And I think, you know, it could be for either of you, both of you. Do individual attitudes towards nuclear weapons have anything to do with concepts of their own masculinity and insecurity? Susie, no? Jan, come on.
I don't. I think that question goes to Helen.
I think the question came from Helen, actually.
I would say yes. Yes, they do. And you can see it also how it's come up and talked about, and at least in the margins here, boys and their toys, this kind of language. There is this the way we use power and the way power is associated with the weapons. It definitely plays a big part in how we associate these. They're part of the big boys club. And so on. It's beyond language. It's the culturalization of these stereotypes. But it's significant, and it's an important thing that Wilf thankfully has a lot to say on. Right.
I'm going to say something that it's just not popular at all. But in defense of my male colleagues, who I like very much, and you know, if Hans Christensen were here, I would want to defend him immediately as great examples of progressive thinkers. But I also think, so to part company with Helen, anyone who thinks that women are natural peacemakers has never been anywhere near a girl's dorm. Anyone who thinks that women are natural peacemakers has never been anywhere near a girl's dorm. They should be careful.
Susie?
I would agree with you. And I'm not talking about the biological factor of male and female. I'm talking about the gendered aspects. It's not about sex. It's about gender. And so to associate any sex with peace or not peace, that's not the question. It's how we have identified these roles in society and the associations we make with these roles in society. To say when you talk about killing 100 billion versus killing, you know, only 1 billion, I raised this question and felt like a woman. That's a gendered association, and it's not about sex. So I agree, there are great men working on great issues, there are great women working on great issues, and there are people who are working to perpetuate nuclear weapons who have whatever sex they were born with. It's not about that. So I wanted to jump in and make that clarification, because for me it's a really important distinction. And I like Hans too, he's awesome.
Absolutely. Well, I don't really have too much to add to that, Susie, so thank you. But would agree with that assessment.